You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.
Hello and welcome into the 23rd iteration of the Coast to Coast Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Craycraft, and I'm thrilled to be joined by someone different than Dante. Dante decided to skip out on us tonight. I am joined by Thomas Titley, who is a staff writer for our site, Last Word on Pro Basketball. And you heard him last week, and we're thrilled to have him back. How are we doing, Thomas?
Pretty good. Happy to be on again.
Yeah, it's exciting. The Final Four is now set in place. You have the Oregon Ducks, the Gonzaga Bulldogs, the North Carolina Tar Heels, and the South Carolina Gamecocks as your four teams that will be taking Phoenix by storm come next Saturday when the calendar flips over to April, which March just flew by.
Yeah, the tournament always seems to just go so quickly, and then it's just done before you know it.
Yeah, and it's Sunday right now that we're recording this, and those games that happened Thursday, they feel like they were about 3 weeks ago or so. And I think that's where we will just jump right in. We're going to go region by region, just like we did before. And we're going to start out in the Big Apple, where the East region took place. Top two seeds, Nova and Duke, were nowhere to be found as they were knocked out in the round of 32 each. And we have to start with maybe the best, or at least top four game in this tournament so far. And that was the Wisconsin Badgers sadly falling in defeat to the Florida Gators with two amazing late game shots. First, the running floater thing by Zach Showalter, where he turns to the crowd, starts doing discount double check to Aaron Rodgers as he's in the crowd. And then Florida matches it with their own running floater three-pointer of their own to give them the victory. This was a spectacular game, and it kind of put into effect how historic MSG can be and how amazing of a place it really is.
It was one of the crazier games of the tournament. I have to say, that celebration was genius. That's one of the best celebrations I've ever seen.
Yeah, it certainly was. And Chris Chioza was the man who hit the shot. If you haven't seen it, you have to, because it was such a strange looking shot, but it captivated us all, and it allowed Wisconsin to move on to the Elite Eight, where they were able to take on the South Carolina Gamecocks, who defeated Baylor by 20 whopping points. I was blown away by this. I saw Baylor going to the Final Four, so for them to come out and put out a performance like this when everyone had doubted them all tournament long. I know I had them losing to Marquette in the first round. And you just see how good of a player Sindarius Thornhill really is. He's got, I think, like over 17 points in the last like 17 points at least in the last like 19 games or some stat like that. And it was very impressive to see. And he's a baller. There's no other way to say it.
Well, there's a reason that he's SEC Player of the Year. Despite his size, he's not the biggest guy. I believe he's only about 6'5", but he really likes to mix it up. And what's really apparent to me when watching his game is how unorthodox it is. He's a capable spot-up shooter, but he really loves to get in that high post area and attack from there. And he's a solid finisher, for sure. He's just an aggressive player.
Right, he's very physical for his size, and he almost seems like a Philly basketball player, almost just like the toughness he plays with and just the style he plays with. But whenever I see him shoot the ball, I don't expect him to miss. He's shooting 42% or so from three in the tournament, and he's been one of the top. If you were to make a starting five of the best players in the tournament so far, he has to be on it because he's been awesome leading this upstart Gamecocks team to the Final Four, and they got there by being able to topple the Florida Gators. That one ended in a final score of 77-70. Thornwell was once again the story. You had the battle of the former Will Muschamp schools and MSG, and that was very fun to watch. And just overall, South Carolina's defense and their toughness and Coach Frank Martin just leading them to victory was the story, and they're now in the Final Four, which blows me away.
Well, the fact that of how they're doing it, and they're so different from most other teams that we've seen. There have been other upstart teams. Wichita State is the most recent one that comes to mind. But they had some real firepower players offensively when you think about Cle'Anthony Early. Fred Van Vliet was there. Ron Baker was there. Those guys could really score. The only real player that you think you can just give the ball to, there might be two, would be Sundarius Thornwell and P.J. Dozier. But other than that, they don't really have elite scorers, you would say. They just shut down Florida. Florida only shot 26% from three, and this is a very good three-point shooting team.
Yeah, that's much of what Florida relies on. Mike White's blank stares the entire tournament have been very funny to watch, just because that's kind of his go-to look. And many people thought Florida was going to win this game, and South Carolina just continues to surprise everyone, and they're going to Phoenix, and they'll take the champion of the West region, who happens to be Gonzaga. And Gonzaga started off this week by beating West Virginia in the first game of the Sweet 16. That was it was a very close game. Gonzaga had trouble battling with West Virginia, handling the press Virginia, as some might say, and they really just couldn't hit shots whatsoever. They had some trouble dealing with West Virginia's press. They didn't turn the ball over quite as much as maybe other teams have. 16 turnovers, which is still way above their season average, but West Virginia's done worse to teams. And they were able to come out with the win. Nigel Williams-Goss honestly seemed frustrated with his level of play in that one, not meeting his standards, I'd say. And West Virginia had their chances, but Javon Carter just loves to dribble the air out of the ball, and that's what kind of happened on that last possession against Gonzaga on Thursday.
That last possession was woeful by West Virginia. They had the ball three times in the last 20 seconds. Two offensive rebounds. One of them for sure was an air ball. I think one of them might have nicked the rim. And then they just dribbled the ball out to end the game. It's clear that team...
And I think there was only like one pass, and that was the pass from the offensive rebounder to Javon Carter each time.
It's clear that team just didn't have another guy. And Javon Carter, they relied too much offensively on Javon Carter. And that was the knock on the team. How did they score? They have to turn people over. In fairness, they did turn Gonzaga over. I believe they only averaged 12 turnovers a game. Nigel Williams-Goss did not handle that press well. I was pretty shocked because he's usually pretty sure-handed. But Javon Carter was the only player for West Virginia that scored in double digits. And that's something you can't win games against elite teams. And Gonzaga is an elite team. They're one of the best teams in the country. There's no doubt. You can't win games against teams like that when only one player scores double figures.
Well, they only shot 26.7% from the field on the entire game. They had 16 more shots than Gonzaga, 19 offensive rebounds. You should be able to win that game, especially when you're turning teams over and getting easy buckets at the rate that West Virginia can. So that really was their only way of offense between Javon Carter and getting those easy buckets, and that's why they're out of the tournament. But Gonzaga moved on, and they ended up playing the winner of Xavier versus Arizona, which was one of the once again one of the better games of the tournament, because Arizona once again collapsed, and Sean Miller is still, I think now that Mark Few and Dane Altman are in the Final Four, I think he's almost certainly the best coach in the country who hasn't made the Final Four. Maybe you could put Tony Bennett in there from Virginia, but there aren't too many others who you can really put in that category anymore. And it's just a matter of time before Arizona gets there. But this was not the year, as Chris Mack's Musketeers took out Arizona in a very close game. And I thought that was a very well-played game. And I was overall very impressed by Xavier being able to come back and win that one. And just their offense, just in terms of their half-court offense, they were in some of the most impressive sets I've seen in the entire country.
Well, the game-winning basket for in that game for Xavier, the play where they they drew it up out of a timeout, and they dumped it down to Sean O'Mara, who made a beautiful cut, and he had a wide-open layup. You rarely see game-winning baskets that easy. That was a great play. And that was kind of a weird game because, as we've said all tournament, Xavier will only go as far as Blewett takes them. And in the first half, again, he couldn't miss. And then his counterpart, Alonzo Trier, could not hit a shot. And then the roles were kind of reversed in that second half. Alonzo Trier got hot and Blewett got cold. And that's really what brought the game close. Arizona just couldn't string together enough stops at the end of the game. And there were some question marks with some of the shot selection made, especially by Trier, who at the end of the game, he was red hot and he just took way too many heat checks.
Yeah. Actually, that last position, though, where he took that three at the top of the key, I didn't hate it a ton, but I think you can live with that shot. But yeah, the previous possessions in those last 2 minutes, I wasn't a big fan of the shots that they were able to get. But their offense was just completely stagnant against that 2-3. And I think that has, in a large part, to do with Lauri Markkanen, because he just wasn't able to get it going from the field. And as a pro prospect, you're not supposed to evaluate a guy based on one game, but that certainly kind of it raised some questions in my mind. I still love the guy, but he just his ability to kind of fade out of games is something to watch.
I believe I said he could be a top five pick last episode.
Yes, you did.
I might eat my words a little bit. I would still take him top 7 or 8 for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
What he did this year, he broke some incredible records. In January, he was shooting 50% from three with at least 93 pointers attempted. That's insane. He's an incredible talent. I personally didn't love the fit for him at that school because it seemed a lot of the times he just ended up circling the perimeter, waiting for Jackson Cartwright or Alonzo Trier to make a play and penetrate and then kick out for him. I've watched him a little bit in international games for Finland, and he seems a lot more comfortable in that kind of mid-range, high-post area, which is where he'll get a lot of touches in the NBA. Obviously, he'll be a big-time three-point shooter there as well. Well, the question now is if he'll come out at all, because I read somewhere that...
Oh, he has to...
I read earlier that he wouldn't make his decision for a while, and that when he joined Arizona, they had a 2-year plan, and that even if he had an incredible first season, he was going to come back for another season to work on his body.
So, I'm not going to believe that until I see it.
I still think he'll come out, but it makes it a little interesting, and... Cause, if they can keep him, that would be huge because he's a baller.
I can't see that. It's not even like he has a pretty impressive body for a what is he? He's probably 19.
He's 19. He's 7'2", 230.
Yeah, and he's not like as scrawny as some of these other guys you see. He's bigger than a guy like last year's pick Dragan Bender is. He's thicker. Pick. He's a better rebounder. What?
That was just a terrible pick though. Let's call a spade.
I'm gonna let time tell. It doesn't look great right now, but they've also it looks like they may have nailed the Marquise Chris pick. So we'll wait to see. But Lauri, I think if he comes out, he's easily top 7. And part of the reason that he may have dropped out of the top 5 could be other guys playing their way in there. And we'll talk about one certain guy who I think has made his way in there. Maybe a guy that you don't love, but that comes when we get to the South region. But the final game of that West region was Xavier against Gonzaga, played in San Jose, and Gonzaga got the best of Xavier. Xavier kind of showed why they kind of struggled all year long, just not being able to match up with such a talented team. Xavier had huge preseason expectations, and they just weren't able to live up to it. Gonzaga's defense stifled them, holding them to 35% from the field, and 2 for 16 from three. So Gonzaga just came out to play and Xavier wasn't ready for it.
And again, Blewett finally just calmed down. That second half from Arizona carried over. He shot 3 for 14 from the field and 1 of 6 from three. He only had 10 points. They just can't win. with performances like that from him. Not to blame him, they wouldn't even be here without him. JP Makura, he had a great game. He had 18 points, but he was really the only guy that could just find his shot. And then defensively, there were clear matchup problems. They didn't have a guy who could handle the athleticism and quickness of Jonathan Williams, who had an incredible game. He had 19 points, 8 of 12 shooting. He was, even though Nigel Williams-Goss had 23, he did it on a lot more shots. Williams brought energy. He made a three. He was great the whole game.
Yeah, they flat out just outplayed him. Shooting 50% from three for Gonzaga certainly helped that. That was very impressive. And people like Jay Billis, who aren't necessarily Gonzaga fans, kind of had to eat their words as Mark Few finally makes a Final Four after making so many of those NCAA tournaments, where they will take on South Carolina, and that'll be the early game of the Final Four. That one, it will be 6 o'clock Eastern, 3 o'clock Pacific, followed by the latter game, which I'll hold you guys in suspense if you don't know who it is. And that we'll start with the South region, where the Elite Eight matchup was UNC and Kentucky. UNC's path to getting there was to defeat Butler, who I thought that game was honestly going to be closer. They ended up beating them by 12, 92-80. But I expected Butler to give them a fight the whole game. And the only reason that game was really that close is because Butler made a nice little run there at the end. But North Carolina took care of them, and they showed why they're probably the favorites come the Final Four.
Well, the reason Butler just didn't match up well with a team like North Carolina with that size and that played at that pace, that's not something that they see a lot. Their only real big man is Shravis, who was first team all Big East, I think. And but
he's really good too.
He's an outstanding player. He was there for their last run to the finals. I think he was a recruit that year.
Yeah, possibly. I don't remember him terribly well, but yeah.
I think he redshirted that year, but he was one of the last holdover players from that team.
Yeah.
But he can't be everywhere, and the guy who broke out that game was Luke May, who was a walk-on his first year. He had offers from Notre Dame, I believe, but he's a North Carolina kid. He wanted to go to UNC. He got a scholarship for his sophomore season. His first career double-double, career-high 16 points. He was outstanding that game. He dominated. He's one of the big men on that team that if they do win, I think he will be key because, again, he can shoot threes. He can stretch it out a little bit more. Meeks, Hicks, and Bradley aren't really great shooters. Hicks and Meeks will make a mid-range jump shot every once in a while, but they don't really space out a team like May does.
Yeah. And that he does add a little bit of versatility to that team, who are led by guards Joel Berry and Justin Jackson, who those two guys in that Butler game combined for 50 points, and that really was the difference. The Butler's guards, Kamar Baldwin's a really good player, but he isn't quite at that level. He had some good moves and stuff, but he just wasn't able to get there. And Tyler Lewis and Keelan Martin are their other two name guys, and they weren't able to get it done for Butler as they bowed out in the Sweet 16. And then the other Sweet 16 game, which everyone was kind of raving about, and it honestly didn't really live up to the hype. That was the NBA-laden matchup of UCLA versus Kentucky. This was probably the peak LeVar Ball we've seen so far. All the talk was of him coming to the tournament, and we don't have to talk about him because Dante and I talked about him on our last show in regards to the NBA. So I don't think that guy needs any more airtime. But this was the De'Aaron Fox show, and I think that's where we got to start. You last week we talked about how you weren't a huge fan of his, and I want to know if you have changed your evaluation at all after what we saw out of him destroying a potential top two pick in Lonzo Ball.
My opinion on him hasn't changed that much because I always knew he was capable of that. Even when I wasn't a big fan of him, I still thought he would go top six for sure. My question was, is he as good as those other guards by that I mean Ball and Markel Fultz. And he dominated Ball. He dominated Lonzo. And it actually raised a couple of questions with me. Ball is a freak athlete, 6'5", but he just did not look engaged defensively at any point in that game.
I don't know if I'd call him a freak athlete. I think his size certainly helps, but his athleticism, he's very talented vertically, but I think when we're talking about quickness, and that's what De'Aaron Fox just blew him away with. De'Aaron Fox is, I think you have to say he's the quickest out of all these elite point guards. Just his ability to weave around a pick and roll, and if you're not going under that, he's going to blow by you. And even if you do, he can still get by you just because of his raw quickness. There are some I do agree that there are some questions, but just from the prospect side, real quick, we'll get back to the actual basketball side. If not, where do you think he's going to get drafted? But where do you have him on the Thomas Titley big board? You think like 8th maybe?
Well, it all depends with fit, and we don't really know.
But let's say you have your team, and this is just...
I'd probably take him probably 5 or 6.
And I have to imagine he's moved up a spot or two just due to this weekend's performances.
I would switch him and Markkanen, that's for sure.
Yeah, there you go.
Again, it is all with fit. For example, if the Timberwolves get lucky and move up a couple spots, then they're not going to take De'Aaron Fox, they're going to take Lauri Markkanen. So,
yeah,
I would put him 5 or 6 for me. I think Fultz is number one. Then I'd go Ball. Then it's a bit of a toss up between either Jackson or Tatum, and then probably Fox, and then Dennis Smith Jr.
That's interesting. Yeah, we really got to do an NBA draft pod because I have a bunch of NBA draft thoughts, and you listing your top 6 players got me all giddy inside. But back into that matchup, we saw some of Ball's flaws. He didn't play terrifically well, and UCLA didn't. I mean, they still shot 39% from 3, which is really good, and they still hit shots, but they just fell short of Kentucky's level. I think this was one of the games where you actually saw Calipari actually do a good job of coaching. I'm a bigger Calipari fan than some. But I think he clearly outcoached Steve Alford. And I think this was almost a good thing for Indiana fans to see, just to show that maybe Alford isn't the kind of guy you want. And they went out and hired Archie Miller, which I think is a great hire, and we can get to that a little bit later as well. But overall, Kentucky winning this game on the backs of De'Aaron Fox and even Malik Monk, who had 21 points as well and played very well. And he's an intriguing prospect as well. And that led us to our matchup today, the marquee matchup in the South region, voiced by the voice of the tournament, Jim Nance. He was in Memphis for that game. And that was the Kentucky Wildcats against the North Carolina Tar Heels. This one came down to the wire. It was a tremendous game. One of the games of the year, I'd say. I know you watched this game and the previous game between the two teams closer this year. Which one do you think was actually like a better game, including the stakes and everything? Because you have the first one was 102-100, Kentucky wins. The second one 75-73. The pace in the other one was bigger, but the stakes were so much bigger in this one.
I would say this one simply because, one, the importance of this game made it a big difference. There were stretches of this game that were ugly, that were just not, it wasn't great basketball to watch. I mean, it was still enjoyable, but there was a period where North Carolina didn't score for 13 straight possessions, where they either missed a shot or turned it over. That was ugly to watch. And then in the last 5 minutes, similar to what happened in the Arkansas game, between minute 5 and probably 1.5, I don't think Kentucky scored a basket when UNC made a bit of a comeback. And again, that was
They went on that 10-0 run.
That was pretty ugly to watch on Kentucky's part as well. It was, but the last minute was incredible. It was two shots by Monk, and a De'Aaron Fox three. All three of those shots were big time. And then Luke May, as we mentioned him before, hit that step back jumper with 0.3 seconds left. The unsung hero that nobody really knew about before. As a Tar Heel fan, I'm happy that he's only a sophomore because he's one of those guys that is just going to get better as he grows into his body a little bit. I think the refs muddied the game up a little bit. They called a lot of ticky-tack fouls. And
was it on both sides?
It was on both sides, but it hurt Kentucky a lot more. In the first half, I think Adebayo, Monk, and Fox didn't play for the last 8 minutes because they were all
I know Fox and Monk were in big foul trouble in that first half.
Yeah, they were from the very beginning, and then Adebayo got into it as well in the later parts of the first half. And so that really kind of took some of the energy out of the game. And there was a part of the game early on when North Carolina was in some foul trouble as well. And then Joel Berry went down. He went to the locker room with a rolled ankle. And they had Sterling White, who...
Stillman White.
Who played well in his 5 minutes of action. Scored a basket. Stillman White, Luke May, Nate Britt, Tony Bradley, and I'm forgetting who the last person... I think it was Theo Pinson. None of those guys are exactly... big names against a lineup of Michael Mulder, Dominique Wilkins, and a couple other guys.
Dominique Hawkins.
I always say Wilkins. Hawkins, who actually, he was outstanding.
Yeah, he's been underrated all year long. He's been very important for them, a senior leader. And the other guy that really showed up for Kentucky that many didn't see coming was Isaac Humphreys, who was kind of Kentucky's version of Luke May, if you will, I'd say. He had his career high points, 12 points, and that was very surprising to watch. I didn't see him being the difference maker.
I love that kid. I remember watching him play Canada in an under 19 tournament, and he destroyed the Canadian team. He is an interesting prospect because as he continues to work on his body, he was had a little bit of baby fat, was a little bit bigger. When he got to Kentucky, a little slow-footed. He looks a lot more nimble this year. He's got a beautiful mechanics on his jump shot. He's got great touch. He's strong. He's one of those guys, if he continues to develop, he could find himself on an NBA roster because he's got some interesting
tools. I don't think so.
I'm serious. His shooting, if he's able to move that out, I remember when he got there, a lot of people were, he's young. He was only
a sophomore,
but he came a year early. He was only 17 because he graduated early or something.
Reclassified, yeah. Something like that.
So he's extremely young. He's still only 18. He's one of those guys. If he can somehow manage to slim out his body a little bit and he refines his game, I mean, you never know. You've seen crazier things happen. He's got some talent. I don't ever think he'll be a drafted guy, but he's the kind of guy that a free agent would sign and be interesting.
He'll be the Justin Hamilton of the Nets of the next Nets. I guess I can kind of see that. But yeah, that was a fantastic game. The most surprising part for me was I saw Monk off, and that was weird. He in that last 3 minutes or so, he took a three, and I think it missed the rim and just slid off the side of the backboard. And then he comes back and he nails two ridiculous shots. Fox showed a three-pointer that I don't think is still... It's not reliable at all, but it's somewhere in there. I think eventually it might come out.
Which is strange, because when you watch him shoot, he has great mechanics. He has good form. There's something about his confidence, I think. I remember I saw an interview with his high school coach, and apparently he was quite a capable shooter in high school. Hmm. And it's just kind of lost him. I think it's more of a confidence thing for him. There might be one or two little tweaks, but he's got solid form. There's nothing obviously broken.
I mean, a good reference point is always the free throws, and he shot 74% this year, which means that's not really typically conducive of a 23% three-point shooter. So if he can get to when he's at the next level, the NBA average of say 34%, 35%, I think he'll be terrifying. He'll be able to survive.
He'll be terrifying. And, well, it showed in a bit in that UCLA game. He got around a couple screens with some pull-up mid-range jumpers that looked great.
And yeah, I still have some hesitations about that pull-up, but I'm a huge Fox guy, so I'm a believer.
What worried me was Monk, though. When Justin Jackson guarded him, Malik Monk is, what, 6'4", 6'3"?
Let's check. He is 6'3".
Yeah, and so at the next level, he's not a point guard.
He's a combo guard.
And at the next level, he'll be a top 10 pick, or he should be. He's talented. But what happens when you put a taller, longer guard? Because not only did he just miss shots, he couldn't even get the ball. The denial that Jackson did using his length was actually quite impressive.
I'm going to be perfectly honest. I didn't realize Monk was so short. He feels taller, like just the way he plays. He doesn't feel like he's 6'3". Because 6'3", and his play style, that... Yeah. And if he's 6'3", and plays the way he does, and he's not a point guard, he's, what, like Lou Williams?
Exactly. Like, that was my thought when I found out how tall he was. My first thought was Monte Ellis. But I don't want to put him into that category because I think he can be better. Monte Ellis is a very good player. But that's what you kind of worry about when you think about him at the next level.
That's fair. I think he has to develop some ball skills because at this level, when you're basically the NBA is trying to get to the point where everyone on the court is the exact same size, they just have different skill sets. It's tough to play with a 6'3", 2 guard. But I think with his talent, he'll find a role. That 6'3 thing is shocking to me. I honestly thought he was like 6'5".
Well, that's what people said about Jamal Murray.
Well, but Jamal
Murray played point guard for a long time. In high school, he was a point guard. And I don't think he has played point guard, Monk.
Yeah. And Jamal Murray showed more ball skills, and he's showing them now in the Nuggets, which is awesome because I love that guy. But, I have some questions, and I'll have to go watch him some more now that I know he's 6'3", because that's concerning. And our final region, the Midwest, the Elite Eight matchup was Kansas and Oregon. Kansas getting there by way of defeating the Purdue Boilermakers by a score of 98-66. It was a pretty close game throughout, and then Kansas just turned on this like super duper new level that we hadn't seen out of anyone else in college basketball. And if they stayed at that level, they would be the best team in the country by far. But it isn't sustainable. But they showed it for a little bit in that second half, where they're throwing behind the back passes to wide open dunks and all this fun stuff. 360
breakaway dunks, and they dominated Purdue, which kind of blew up in my face. I thought Purdue would give them a problem. I thought going in that Purdue had a legitimate chance to win. They're a good team. But Kansas just looked on another level, and then it went a full 180 against Oregon, where they looked awful.
Yeah, and in that Purdue game, the dynamic backcourt of Devontae Graham and Frank Mason combined for 52 points, which was crazy. They shot over 50% from three in that one, so that was the difference in that one. And then, as you said, the Oregon Ducks were able to top the Michigan Wolverines, and that game was very close. It was pretty exciting as well. Tyler Dorsey continues to just wow in March. People around here are calling him Mr. March, which I think is fitting with the way he's played this year. I think he's either at 7 or 8 straight games of 20-plus points, which is very surprising, and He hit the go-ahead three from way downtown, which was very surprising. And then Oregon honestly should have fouled on the last possession on Derek Walton. And Derek Walton got the shot that he wanted, and it just didn't fall. But the Ducks survived, and that's kind of what they've been doing so far in this tournament.
They seem to just squeak by a lot of teams, even though the box score might say they won by double figures for some of their games. It's always close until late. But they've also had every game Dorsey shot the lights out. He's been brilliant. If Brooks hasn't had a bad tournament, but he hasn't quite played up to the expectations of Pac-12 Player of the Year. I thought he would be a little more dominant. Still been very good. If he really connects and clicks, he could be a huge problem going forward.
Well, I think, and in the Kansas game, you probably saw his best game of the tournament so far. Maybe Iona was better, but I don't remember that one as clearly as the other close ones. But in the Rhode Island game and the Michigan game, he hasn't been as good as he has as he was throughout the year. And against Kansas, he looked more like his normal self. It was still Tyler Dorsey who stole the show, 27 points in that one, and that one wasn't very close most of the game. I mean, like for the last 25 minutes of the game.
No, it wasn't. It felt a little close because Frank Mason was
well. That and that Kansas had all their fans there.
Yeah, so every time Kansas kind of made a shot and they would pull it. It wasn't even that close. It'd be like
8.
It'd be 10 or 12, and everyone freaks out. But it was never that close.
It was like a home game where like if once they hit a shot, they're down 10. Everyone rises their feet. The camera pans out. It makes it feel like it's very close. But they did get it down to 6 at one point, and that got me a little scared. And then Dorsey comes down and nails a 3, and that's about as close as it got throughout the game.
Everyone is going to give Dorsey the player of the game there, and he had 27 points. He shot 60%.
No, I know what you're going to say. It's Jordan Bell.
He was incredible. I haven't seen a performance like that from a big man in a while. He had 8 blocks. 8 blocks.
He's special.
13 rebounds, 8 blocks, 5 or 6 shooting for 11 points, and he had 4 assists too.
Yeah, he's improved so much. It's crazy. In that game, they were struggling a little bit on offense. He got a post touch and he shows a little post fade, which I've never seen in my life from him. It was crazy.
Well, he did a shot like that last game against Michigan, if I recall correct. Maybe it was Michigan or maybe it was one of the earlier games. But he did another shot in this tournament, and I just kind of sat back and went, "Oh, Jordan Bell, trying to get in the NBA? Are you?"
In my eyes, I think he's gone. I think he's going to leave. He's a junior now. I expect him to leave. Oh, what? No, he's not a senior. This is wrong. He's definitely not a senior.
He's a junior for sure.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, CBS. I expect him to leave, but he's been terrific. He won Most Outstanding Player of the Midwest Region. Dorsey and Brooks were also on that team. And they beat a team that I honestly didn't think they could beat. I didn't think they could beat Kansas, and they were able to. Now they have a matchup with UNC, which I think is super intriguing. Any final thoughts on the Midwest region before we do a quick little preview of those two Final Four games?
Just the fact that Oregon-Kansas game, it could have been a lot worse for Kansas. Frank Mason had 21 points, and Devontae Graham was 0 for 7 for 3 points. If it wasn't for Frank Mason, that's a 20-point game blowout.
Yeah.
And Oregon's scary. There was a great comment made during the game by one of the commentators that the energy that Jordan Bell gives, I think it was Reggie Miller, that's the kind of thing GMs look for at the next level.
Yeah, he knows his skill set, and I think it might end up finding him a role in the NBA. Honestly, he has some Kenneth Freed in him. Not much outside skill, but he brings a lot of energy. He's a good rebounder. He's a better defensive player than Freed is, but just spitballing ideas. I don't think he's going to slip in the first round, but I think he leaves. He's going to be a second rounder. I think Brooks will do the same. I personally think Dorsey is going to leave as well. I don't think he's going to be a very good NBA player, but I think he's going to leave because he's never played this well before.
The thing for Dorsey is his stock has never been higher.
That's what I always say.
If I were to compare him to a player, it would be Seth, not Steph Curry. Like, he could become that. Little undersized, good shooting stroke, not the quickest, not the best athlete, but a good player. If he does go out, he'll play in the D League for a little bit, and like Seth, he might get a chance.
I think he'll light up the D League just because they don't play tough defense. But
yeah, if I'm an Oregon fan, I'm ecstatic for what's going on right now. But I would be actually quite worried for next year, because next year...
I'm not. I think this is an extremely... Well, I don't think that necessarily this will be a projected Final Four team, but they have a lot of pieces coming in, and I don't... Do you want to go full Oregon and actually break this all down? Because I can, but I just don't know.
I mean, they lose their five best players.
Five? Oh, well, yeah, you can... Yeah.
Dylan Ennis is a senior. He's gone. Chris Boucher is a senior, and is, if not for his injury, would be drafted. I've still seen him on draft boards after his injury, so...
He might get drafted if a team wants him and not a draft and stash.
Yeah. Dorsey, like, we agree that because of how he's playing, is probably gone.
There's a small chance he stays still, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, and then Brooks and Bell will both certainly be drafted. So that's your five best players.
Yeah.
That's my opinion. You do have some good... Oregon has some good recruits, but in my opinion, I don't think they'll be as successful as they were in the last 2 years.
No, I don't think so either. I think this is... Unless Dane Altman is like a legitimate top five coach of the country, I think this is the peak for Oregon. I still think they can compete for the Pac-12 next year. They have a five-star in Troy Brown coming in. They're in the running for another five-star, and he's a big man named Brandon McCoy. They have a transfer from Georgetown named Paul White, who will play the four, and he's sitting out this year. He'll be good. MJKH hasn't played. What's up?
Is Abu Keegab next year?
Yes, he is next year. And then a lefty point guard named Victor Bailey, who will be good. And they still have their two point guards returning. The Cavell Bigby Williams is back, who I think will make strides during the offseason. And then there's a chance they get some of these Washington guys now that Romar is gone.
They seem to always get the JUCO Player of the Year.
Yeah.
That's what they did with Boucher and Bigby Williams, so you never know. Yeah. That could happen again.
And it varies in results, obviously, because Boucher was a better player than Bigby Williams is. I think Bigby Williams could be good, but he's not there yet.
I don't think anyone thought Boucher would be this good, though.
Well, no. He was awesome. It's very cool to see them supporting him the way they are. And now they're in the Final Four. Dane Altman makes his first Final Four after coming from Creighton and being here for... I guess it's 14 years or so now. And now we get to break down the Final Four. That first matchup on the left side of the bracket, I guess, South Carolina against Gonzaga. I'm curious to see whether South Carolina's defense can hold up or whether Gonzaga is able to pick them apart the way they were able to pick apart Xavier.
It's a lot easier for defense to be consistent than offense. Because you can have a guy that's just having an off day. Like in that West Virginia game, that shouldn't have been that close. But there were a lot of guys for Gonzaga who were just struggling to hit shots. So I'm not going to say South Carolina's out of it, because they've beaten some really good teams. Florida was an exceptional team. Duke, a lot of people had Duke winning. But this Gonzaga team's different from those guys. I think Gonzaga, Duke's probably about as good. But I wouldn't argue that Duke's better. I do think Gonzaga's a little bit better than Duke. And they have more to offer all around. When you look at, they have three-point shooting, they have a couple of big men inside, they have elite guard play. It'll be tough to see South Carolina win this game, because they don't really play a ton of bodies. I think they only go eight deep. It'll be a tough matchup. Especially for Silva and Cozart. They really only have two bigs. Thornwell does his best to be another power forward.
I think an interesting matchup is if Thornwell ends up on Jonathan Williams, if they put him on him. Because that I actually could see Thornwell doing decently well in that one, actually. Faring pretty well.
That's the thing. Jonathan Williams has really been the X factor in most of their games. He's been, I wouldn't say the best player in every game, but he's made a huge difference he's been the most consistent guy. And Thornwell, because of his speed and strength and just grit, he's a guy that can actually slow Williams down.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting matchup. I think whether PJ Dozier is able to create despite Gonzaga's great guard play, is going to be interesting. I don't know what the line on this one is, but I guess Gonzaga's a 6-point favorite probably or so. I think it'll be a good game. I really hope Gonzaga doesn't blow them out, because I want both of these final four games to be close. I want every basketball game to be close pretty much. But it's an exciting matchup. I think Frank Martin is going to have his team ready to play, and we'll see if Mark Few, given what he's got, he has a full week to prepare for this. So I think if we'll really see if his team comes out ready to play, and if they're hitting shots, you better watch out, because this team is probably the most well-rounded in the entire tournament.
That the Baylor game against South Carolina, it's not that Baylor wasn't prepared. They just didn't shoot well. They don't really have the same weapons.
Right. It's different.
As Gonzaga. And then you can easily make the argument Florida, they had one day preparation against that defense. That's difficult.
And that Florida Wisconsin game for Florida was so probably mentally draining. You have to factor that in.
Oh, for sure. I definitely agree. They looked tired in that South Carolina game, where South Carolina, I mean, they always look at this. It's just the way that they play. They just play really, really hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I assume we're both picking the Zags in that one, correct?
I really want to pick South Carolina, but I can't.
Yeah.
I enjoy the Cinderella, but I can't do it.
Yeah, I think it'll be a good game, and I think South Carolina might travel halfway decently well, because their fans are extremely fired up about this, making their first ever Final Four. I know Gonzaga fans are excited.
As they should be.
Yeah. And Gonzaga is going to travel well with their smaller fan base, I think. A lot of people have been rearing and waiting for this time to come. And then on the other half, you have my favorite team against your favorite team. And it's an exciting matchup for sure. There's a reason why this one is slated as the later game, just because it has more name brand and just the Oregon brand and the North Carolina basketball brand in general. It's going to be exciting. I think for me, the first thing that stands out is whether Jordan Bell can play the North Carolina bigs off the floor, because he's been able to do it in just about every other matchup. And it's a scary proposition if you're a Tar Heel fan.
Unfortunately for Oregon, I don't know if he will. He's going to have to play almost 40 minutes, 100%. Kansas, we mentioned this in the last podcast, they have incredibly good guards, but they do not have any single great forwards, and Bell dominated. The game that gave them more trouble was Michigan, and Michigan has a little more depth, a couple more big men players. And when you stack Michigan's big to North Carolina's bigs, it's not even close. North Carolina blows them out of the water. I really think that Oregon's going to have a tough time in this game. They're going to have to be red hot.
I mean, it's possible. I'm not going to rely on it, because them being red hot, I don't rely on that unless they're at home, and they're not going to be at home in this one. I think... What? They'll put Justin Jackson on Dylan Brooks, right?
Oh, 100%. Or, actually, they
and
could put
Pinson,
Theo Pinson.
And then Pinson on Dorsey, right?
They could. It could be either or. Pinson's a little more physical than Jackson.
Who's the 4 and the 5 for Carolina?
Isaiah Hicks and Kennedy Meeks.
Who are they going to change their starting lineup? Because Dylan Brooks starts at the 4.
It's possible.
So you either put one of them on Brooks, or you put one of them on like Dylan Ennis, and good luck with that.
I mean, I could see them putting Hicks on Brooks and trying it out. Hicks is for a big guy, he's incredibly mobile.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if they try that, and if it doesn't work, then who knows. But again, it might just be a thing of, can you stop us? They might just roll with it and say, if you guys can stop us, go for it.
I think Joel Berry poses big problems for the Ducks. I agree. First of all, but the thing about their defense is that they switch so much that he won't be on him all the time. And it's just whether Jordan Bell can protect the rim and maybe get Joel Berry a little scared of driving in there. It's an intriguing matchup.
I think the scarier thing than Joel Berry is Justin Jackson, because of the amount of switching. The moment Pritchard is on him, the moment Benson is on him, Dylan Ennis is a really strong guy, but he's only about 6'3", and Jackson's a legit 6'8". And the quickness of his release on his shot is outstanding.
Yeah.
The moment one of those guys get on him, it's just going to be straight to him. He's going to get the ball right away. And so that's, I think, Oregon, if you stack them up talent-wise, it's pretty close. But when you look at it matchup-wise, that's the issue for Oregon.
Yeah, it's just who's going to get their way. One thing about that you just mentioned, I think the other thing about that other semifinal, Gonzaga, South Carolina's been able to control the tempo in every single game they've played. If they can do that against Gonzaga, then they have a chance. But back to that, do you want to say anything about that? Or?
No, I definitely agree. But Gonzaga is not a team that really plays fast.
True.
So I think it would be, if it was Oregon or North Carolina, I would say that would be the key for Frank Martin, would be keeping the pace low, because both of those teams love to run out. North Carolina will run after a made basket. Gonzaga really likes to play slow and play through Karnowski and Collins and Williams and get to that post area. They love the half court. So I think that's a little bit, it's not going to be a priority for Frank Jackson. I think, if anything, Frank Jackson will want to play faster than Gonzaga and see if Karnowski's...
Frank Martin.
if he'll want to see if Karnowski's 300-pound body can run up and down the floor as many times as he can.
I mean, that's the versatility that Collins gives you, though, having Collins and Williams. Then you just take that out. But, yeah. I saw that North Carolina is a 6-point favorite according to one book, and I think that's fair. I think it'll be close once again. I think North Carolina is the better team, and I probably think they're gonna win. But I don't know. I don't want to do this.
I love Oregon. You know I love Oregon. But I have a feeling they're gonna get blown out.
Wow.
I have a feeling they're going to get blown up. If Jordan Bell picks up a couple fouls, and he loves to block shots, and can be a recipe for disaster of him just going in and being aggressive.
That's the thing. He's been like this for 3 years, though. He's smart enough that he knows not how to not do that. I think if they're getting blown out, it means Dorsey isn't hitting shots. He finishes with, 6 points on the game. Brooks finishes with 17, but he's 6 for 17 on the day, that's easily a 15-point game then. And I can, because I don't know, I'm trying to think. I don't know if Oregon's probably hasn't played a team as productive and fast and athletic as North Carolina is.
So. North Carolina's game plan for Dorsey should be the same as Malik Monk: stick Theo Pinson or Justin Jackson on him and just deny him the ball. Just don't even let him touch it, because he's just red hot. Yeah. And then after that, let Peyton Pritchard beat you. Let Jordan Bell beat you. I think they're probably just going to say Dylan Brooks is going to get his 15. We just can't let Dorsey go off.
Yeah, that's a fair point. They're always man-to-man, right? Or do they ever run zone?
I can't remember the last time I've seen them run zone.
Okay.
Just curious. Yeah, it's very rare, and I can't remember the last time they didn't have two bigs, two legit 6'9" bigs.
I mean, if Oregon can play them out of that, maybe they, because I think Oregon has more guard and wing depth, maybe.
I think they do as well in that case. North Carolina's wings, once you get rid of Berry and Jackson, they're more just kind of role player guys like Nate Britt. Yeah. Not good college players, but not great. They don't do anything mm-hmm. spectacular. And Theo Pinson's the same way.
Isn't that where the injury of Kenny Williams comes in and kind of hurts them?
That really hurts them. It's less, but him is less offensively. He's not a necessarily.
No, it's defense. Wasn't he their best perimeter defender?
He's by far their best. Yeah. I think it's Kenny Williams because Kenny Williams, like, you can put Kenny Williams on De'Aaron Fox, you can put him on Dylan Brooks. He's long and he's quick and he loves to defend.
He's Carolina's injury version of Oregon's Boucher, basically. It's just been he's been out longer, so it's a different hurt, but yeah.
I'm not sure about that because once you lose Boucher, you really only have Bigby Williams, yeah. right? But if you lose Kenny Williams, you still have Jackson and Pinson, who I would say Jackson is a tier above Jordan Bell. And Pinson is a tier above Bigby Williams.
That is fair. Well, it's going to be an exciting game. I know both of us will be tuned in. I think we have to talk about this Final Four at some point. I don't know if it'll be right after it, but we gotta make it happen because we will be caring about these games a ton. Well, I think that's about all we've got. Quickly, do you like the hire of Archie Miller for Indiana?
I love it. Dayton is a team that doesn't get a ton of big time recruits, but they always seem to be in the tournament. When a big school like Indiana wants to replace a coach, I'm a personal fan of for example, what Texas did with Shaka Smart from VCU. It hasn't quite panned out yet, but I'm a fan of finding those mid-major coaches who just seem to get wins. And that's what Oregon did with Dana Altman. They picked him from Creighton. They weren't a big-time team then, but he was the guy
He wasn't quite at the level of like Archie got Dayton up to like a B-plus program, and he was just waiting for the A-plus program to open up. The same thing Shaka did, which I think is a great comparison. And I think it'll work out. The funniest thing I saw today was that Tom Crean was seen at the Indiana women's NIT game, which was funny.
I heard about that.
But yeah, that's a funny story. I also like the Archie hire. I think he'll do good things there. I think he'll succeed. Expectations are crazy high there, so he'll have to make some good impressions early on. But I think he's capable of doing that, and he's got plenty of support in the family, and Sean Miller will get him started on the right step.
I agree.
Well, we thought we were going to go short, but this is almost an hour. So I appreciate your time, Thomas. It was a lot of fun talking some college basketball. And we will talk to you in the near future, whether it's college basketball or the NBA draft. And people can check out your work on your Twitter. Do you want to give your Twitter again?
Yeah, at Thomas Titley. Titley spelled T-I-T-T-L-E-Y.
Yes, and follow our show on Twitter at Coast to Coast Pod, the number two, not the word. We appreciate everyone for listening. For Thomas Titley, I'm Austin Craycraft. And for our forgotten Dante Guarneri, have a good night.